Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Steve Chaney. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the American Security Project. Ms. Worth, there we go. I'm pleased to talk climate and national security today. Let me give you a little background about the American Security Project. Founded in 2005 by some folks you might know, and if this is working, that guy right there, John Kerry, Chuck Hagel, Warren Rudman, and Gary Hart. And if you'll note the political affiliation, it's two Republicans, two Democrats. And I often get criticized for that because the two Republicans are rather moderate, but given the topic, that's what we had to get. And the intent was back then, Kerry was just coming off the 2004 campaign, and whenever he talked climate change, he got painted as a left-wing liberal, Sierra Club, Greenpeace type guy. And he thought it was really sad that this was a national security issue, but intersecting those two issues was not getting across to the public. So the concept was to put together a 501c3 nonprofit and make the board equal Republican-Democrat, but more important, put 8 or 9 what we call flag officers, generals and admirals, preferably 3- and 4-star level, to sit on the board who were retired from all the services, who could talk this issue and the impact of climate change on national security. Now, we didn't just cover that singular topic. We also work on nuclear security, and perhaps one of our biggest successes was getting the same message across, especially on Capitol Hill, in regards to the New START Treaty, which we played a fairly big hand in. And then, of course, we have the intersection of climate and energy, so we have an energy security part component to the organization. We also do American competitiveness, asymmetric operations, and terrorism. And you might note some other folks on here. This one down right there is Christine Todd Whitman. She's former governor of New Jersey, used to be the administrator of the EPA. She is now our chairwoman. And right next to her is Nelson Cunningham, who's our current president. He took over from that guy, who was Admiral Lee Gunn. This is Norm Augustine, former CEO of Lockheed Martin. That's Don Beyer, who just got elected to Congress from Virginia. That's Admiral Fox Fallon, former 4-star combatant commander of Central Command. Lester Lyles, former vice chief of the Air Force, 4-star. John Castelaw, retired lieutenant general of the United States Marine, 3-star. So we've got a really good mix of folks on my board, and we put together 8 or 9 business folks that would help support the organization, and that's we go out and pitch all these issues to the general public. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the science. Now, I think somebody recently fairly famous said, I'm not a scientist, but I know a lot. And I do know a lot of scientists. So I'm going to address the science part of this. Now, I hope to not prove Winston Churchill's axiom true that, as you know, light travels faster than the speed of sound, and some people appear bright until you hear them speak. So if I stumble a little bit, you'll understand. Now, I am a Marine. I did 31 years as a United States Marine, retired as a Brigadier General. And I'm going to cover part of this, but more of the military part in that intersection of national security would be Lieutenant General Dirk Jameson, the former Deputy Commander of Strategic Command and Commander of the 20th Air Force. Dirk, if I got that right? And he will help address this. He spent well over 3 decades in his Air Force career. So let's get on to the science here. We've always said the Earth is warming, and I know you've got deniers here. We think the record is truly indisputable. In the 20th century, the air temperature has increased 1.5 degrees, most of that since 1970. And you will see on this particular graph, 1970 falls right about there, and I think you'll notice a slight upward tick in compared to what happened between 1880 and 1970, although it went down here, and then it increased, then went down a little bit, and it went up, and I'll talk about those variations here in a minute. The warmest decade on record was the 2000, since 2000. Each of the previous decades was warmer than the decade before, and you can see that very graphically here. I mean, this is the most recent decade, and just look at how the surface temperature has increased in comparison to the others since 1880. And we picked 1880, of course. The Industrial Revolution was pretty much back in this era. And here we are pumping that CO2 at the rapid rate into the environment. The climate has not always changed. And I had this conversation earlier today. You can go back some 450,000 years. Yes, 450,000. That's back in this area. And you can see it's had ups and downs, ups and downs, ups and downs, both sea level temperature and CO2 concentration. But what you will note is when you come right to about here on each one of these graphs, and this kind of follows the normal pattern of the last hundreds of thousands of years, but look at the very tail end, and all of a sudden right there, Holocene period, there is a sharp uptick. And that's what we're seeing now, and we are the ones who are driving this. Global temperature since 10,000 BC, and again, this verifies what I just pointed out a minute ago. You can see ups and downs, and again, it goes down and decreases, but all of a sudden, a very, very sharp spike up. And then global temperatures since in the last 2,000 years. Again, here's this same spike rocketing up. So you'd say, what's causing this? And you heard me reference CO2, and this is the greenhouse effect. And of course, the sun rays come down, get reflected back up. Some keep going, some go out. When you pump CO2 into this, they stay. And as a consequence, the Earth is heating, and we talk about that in the greenhouse effect right here. Here we go. And of course, CO2 is what's causing this. These are the CO2 concentrations since 1880 through the 2000s. And you can see the dramatic, dramatic increase here. I'm sure you've heard this figure before. 97% of published climate papers or climate scientists agree that global warming is certainly happening. And yeah, it's you and me, it's us that are causing this. Now, there are some who might argue what you find from the deniers is they'll look at the 3%, but they'll not consider the 97%. And the analogy I use here is you've got a really sick son, and you take him to 100 doctors, and 97 of them say, you got to operate. And 3% say, nah, I don't think you should do that. What would you do? Think about it for a minute. I think you'd probably agree with the 97%. And you go ahead and operate. And that's where we are. We're here with the climate scientists. One of my favorite shots, Senator Inhofe, just taken a couple of weeks ago on the Senate floor. We've had a fairly cold winter in D.C., which is where my office is. Not much snow, but this particular day, there was a big argument about global warming on the floor. And he had one of his staffers run out and grab a snowball and said, hey, can't you see? How can it be global warming if it's snowing? And here's my point to this. If you look at the skeptics, they will look at these blue lines. And in some cases, that blue line average, for instance, since 2000, and this one here, about 2006 to now, takes a dip down. And these are taken almost in decade increments of the blue ones. But in the aggregate, when you look at this from 1970 on, you can see the trend is clearly up. You will have anomalies. You're going to have spikes. Some are going to days will really be hot, and you're going to have some days and times that are going to really be cold. But when you take that trend in and of itself, certainly since 1880, it has gone up and is going up, and it's going up a lot faster now than it has in the previous century.
We refer to that as aliasing.
Alias?
Aliasing, when you sample in such a way that you get the wrong
effect. Well, precisely. I mean, another analogy I heard today was you got a batter, and the batter steps to the plate in one game and he hits 4 home runs. And this is the first game of the season. He's batting 1,000% and he's really hot. And then he goes the next 10 games, doesn't have a hit one. All of a sudden his average drops to about 100. So you've got to look at the average. If you just looked at that one game, he really did well. But no, you've got to take him in the whole scheme of things. I'm kind of a baseball, not fanatic, but follower. But that analogy rings to me. You've got to look at the whole season. You can't just look at the one game.
Dirk, I don't want to step on your toes here, so when I get to your spot in here, I'm got to make sure I'm getting on the right side of the thing here. So let me page up to where I'm supposed to be. There is no doubt that climate change is causing conflict and problems in this world, and that the United States military has to prepare for this. And we talk about this. The QDR is obviously Quadrennial Defense Review, comes out every 4 years. The last one came out in 2014. And the military guys, those at the higher echelons, clearly understand the threat of climate change and what it's causing to instability and problems to our bases, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. And they talk about this a great deal in the QDR. And there's four or five pages dedicated to climate change in the National Defense Strategy that talk definitely about climate change. We worry about it. We have put out an adaptation roadmap. The Department of Defense has. Every military service is doing really some great things in terms of limiting their pollutions. And the number one consumer of fossil fuels, not just in this country but in the world, is the United States military. Kind of hard to believe, but when you look at the number of aircraft that we have that are flying and that are burning fuel all the time, the number of trucks, cars, vehicles, generators, you can understand why. DOD understands that it's a huge vulnerability to the Department of Defense, and they're trying to get away from it. Plus that they understand climate change and the impact that it's going to have on stability in the world. You can see here, I'm a member of a group called the Global Military Advisory Group on Climate Change, or GMAC. And there are several countries, about 20, that have two flag officers retired that all take on the same idea about climate change. Now, when we surveyed every country in the world, we asked them all, do you consider climate change a threat to your national security? 70% of them, and I think we don't have that up there, but 70% of them said that climate change is a national security threat. What's interesting about this is 30% that said it wasn't were either 30% that either didn't have a military or they're third world countries or had problems otherwise and they weren't the least bit concerned about climate change. But you will note here, everybody in green said climate change was a national security threat. And you can see Russia, China in there, which you might think, maybe not. They know it is. They know it's a problem. And down here, red, they said it's not a concern. And then gray, we just couldn't get anything back from some of these gray countries. And you can understand why when you see where they are, Middle East and in the Maghreb. And why do we worry about it? There's no doubt about it that it's an accelerant of instability. And we're going to give you some very poignant examples here in a minute. And there are certainly hot spots, you know, all over the world that we understand that our military has to respond to that's contributing to all of this. With that, I am going to turn it over to General Jamison.
First of all, it's good to be here at Louisiana State University. Great facilities, great reputation. I like to tell my grandsons who go to some other places where I've been and try to impress them, and this will be impressive. I want to just say up front why I got involved with this group. It's kind of counterintuitive that the military would be talking about climate change. But one of the things that General James said is this is a bipartisan, it's not political, it's based on military judgment from some people that have a few gray hairs. As a matter of fact, every one of those is a story and you don't want to hear them. But I'm very happy to still be vertical at this point. The thing that we may not be always aware of is that the U.S. military, for all its faults, for all the things that we can hold up and question and whether they did it exactly right or exactly wrong, there is a pretty good cadre of people that are always looking at the future and trying to say, what do we need to do to maximize our national security and serve the national security interests of our country. And about, I don't know the exact dates, I know that the American Security Project and the consensus have been going and giving these presentations for about a year. Well, I remember at least 8 years ago when I was working with a young, or communicating with a young group of colonels. Now, I used to think a colonel was an old gray-haired person. These colonels were about 12 years old. And they had been to really spectacular places to get an education, like LSU and Harvard and Texas. I had to throw that in. I'm from Austin, so I apologize. That's the last reference, except we are out in drought. We could use some of your water. These young colonels were looking at the world circumstances in terms of the emerging controversy about the changing climate and what that might mean to national security. They looked at the models, they looked at various things, and they were saying to themselves, wait a minute, if there's any truth to the fact that the ice caps are melting, or that the sea level may rise, we have about $690 billion worth of taxpayer money invested in United States military facilities around the world. And we don't want those underwater, and we don't want them without water. We want them to be able to do their jobs. And they were really putting it together. That if you have dramatic, even catastrophic events that cause large groups of people to either move or to be in great distress where they have to be rescued in a humane way, and some people talk about that some as we go forward, or if you have an emerging location that hasn't been a central focus for a long time, let's just say like the Arctic, then we better start getting our act together. And this group of colonels and captains, that's a Navy captain now, that's still a big deal. They were really putting some heavy substance to the subject. And it started popping up in various places, and I'm so delighted that the consensus got into it. Because it gave old guys like me something to go and talk about, because I really think it's important. Anyway, they looked at what might cause a war to start in some of these places, or at least a conflict. And I've got some slides here which I didn't get to see before we came. I'm just going to see what the next slide is. I think it was already mentioned that these changes can be felt in all kinds of places, and it can affect security. Well, that gets me back to what might have happened that caused this thing in Syria to be such a hot spot. It was a drought. And it caused large migration of people. It caused people to be out of position in terms of their food sources and that kind of thing. And so all of a sudden, things got real nasty. I think that the United States can almost be seen, you may think I'm crazy to say this, as some way instructive, a microcosm. Let's just take California, for example. That's a long way away, something y'all shouldn't worry about down here. But they're running out of water. And they have towns that don't have any water. And I'm not saying that it's going to cause a war with Nevada, but it's causing great tension. And even Oklahoma and Texas can get really eye to eye over where the boundary is for the Red River and some other places. So it's not so hard to say that even though climate change is not the most critical factor in armed conflict, it is a factor, and there are things that the U.S. military has been thinking about for a good period now. I took a trip down the, I mentioned this to the guys after we got off the airplane today. I took a trip down the Mekong River two years ago. I wanted to go back to Vietnam. I'd been there, but I wanted to go back. I actually wanted to visit some places that a lot of my buddies had spent a long period of time in very small, dark rooms. But as we went down the Mekong River, which is a vibrant river, the sixth largest in the world, we learned some things. One, that China needs water. And guess, and they need energy. And guess how they're trying to get it? They're trying to get it by building dams on the Mekong River, which reduces the flow down that river, which reduces the ability of the people that live on that river to support themselves. So it moves toward tension and more than that, possibly toward conflict. So that's just another possible example of why this is important. I think that the nonpartisan basis is important, and I think getting some military people to be able to talk about it and try to give examples of where it's appropriate, why the investments need to be protected, is very very germane to what's going on in space. Now, I'm not going to try to prove it with my vast mathematical background or my incredible environmental history, but I'm just saying that based on my experience, this makes an awful lot of sense to me, and I hope that you would make it a topic of your conversation, since you've certainly dealt with some catastrophic weather events which can change the whole circumstance for a large part of our country. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Steve, and I know I skipped about 19 slides,
no,
so
okay.
You can,
I got
you know, pick those up.
I'll play on them here. You know, you look on the upper left, and I talked about DOD being the biggest consumer of fossil fuels, perhaps, in the world, and it's a huge vulnerability for our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. One of the biggest problems that we've had in Afghanistan and Iraq was transportation of fossil fuels, and this shows a principal example here. If there's any way to wean yourself off of that, we would welcome it, of course. Now, down here, this is Khyber Pass, and this is Haditha Dam in Iraq. Ataturk Dam, Turkey, Arab Spring, and Dirk mentioned this a little bit. Some might not know, but they had huge forest fires in Western Russia and Eastern Europe back in 2010, and it decimated the wheat crop. And as a consequence, the price of wheat went through the roof in the Middle East. And that started to fuel the economic fire throughout Tunisia, Egypt, that Libya, that whole area started to rebel because they weren't, one, getting the bread they needed, and when they did, it was too expensive. So we know there was a direct connection, and what caused the forest fires, of course, were extreme droughts in Russia and Eastern Europe. So we know that was an accelerant to the instability that I mentioned before. Dirk mentioned Syria. Historic drought in Syria over the last 15 years, the worst in their history. It drove, one, they couldn't grow their own food, and secondly, it drove them into the cities. We sent a team to Aleppo year before last. This was before ISIL and ISIS became really bad, to look at the situation there. And of course, what happened was everybody congregated in Aleppo, which is a city now of many millions, and Assad has used that to bomb them with barrel bombs, and it's contributed to the instability that you see in the Middle East. And that's what I just talked about, Syria and Iraqi drought. Sub-Saharan Africa, Mali in particular, and some may
recall the Mali insurrection that occurred 2 years ago, and we know for a fact what drove the Tuaregs out of the south of Mali to the north was a historic drought. They couldn't grow their crops. They had to go somewhere, so they went to the north. Northerners were not too happy to have the Tuaregs there, and thereupon started a fairly fierce battle. Now, it used to be a French territory. The French went down and more or less quelled that. However, you may or may not know, about 90% of the logistic support for the French down there came from the United States. Dirk mentioned, I'm going to talk a little bit about catastrophes. This is Admiral Locklear. Sam Locklear here is the combatant commander for the Pacific Command, meaning he handles all Western Asia and South Pacific and the Pacific for the United States. And he's somewhat well known because he made the statement that he thinks the biggest threat to our national security is climate change. And there are others who've taken the task on it. But here's a guy with firsthand experience, and this is it over here on the left. That's Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. Typhoon Haiyan was the most powerful typhoon in the history of the world. 185 mile an hour winds sustained on the ground. You're all familiar with the damage it did. It's been called by some the perfect storm, and I know they called Sandy a perfect storm. This was much more the perfect storm, much, much, much incredibly more powerful than Sandy ever was. The kicker to this was when it hit the Philippines, who responded? Our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, 12,000 of them. And you might say, why did we do that? Well, number one, we're the only country that could do it. Nobody else can move that amount of supplies, that amount of people, and that amount of time to help people out. And we're humanitarians. We wanted to go help them out, and we did. And they appreciated it. Of course, these types of storms are now increasing dramatically in intensity and frequency worldwide. You might have seen one that hit Vanuatu last week. I mean, and whoever even heard of Vanuatu? We are assisting in that as well. Although Australia is closer and they've done a little bit more. But nonetheless, you can see the impact this is having worldwide, and we are the ones who are responding to these disasters. This is my poster child for climate change. Now, you guys can probably relate, being a coastal state and sea rise and what's happening to your coast, and certainly with catastrophic events. This is Bangladesh, obviously. You can see right here. A 1.5 meter rise in sea level will cause them to have between 20 and 30 million refugees. And there's a major general retired there named Munirazaman, very good friend of mine. He's in the administration there. They've been barking at the administration. Where are we going to put these people? Where are they going? Now, the border right here in between India and Bangladesh, some of us in the room can certainly remember East and West Berlin. That's what that border's like. It's armed, it's mined, and if you cross the border, the Indians will shoot you. So you're not going to send anybody there. Myanmar and India are two different separate cases, and Myanmar has almost the same problem. But you can see the height above sea level here, all these places, they're going underwater. They know for a fact that they're going underwater. There is going to be a humanitarian crisis almost unprecedented that's going to happen in Bangladesh and in South Asia. As well, you may recall there's been a lot of criticism about the Himalayas and the melting of the glaciers, and it's not true, it is true. There is a problem there, I can tell you categorically, that it is melting and it is causing problems. And the next thing you're going to have is going to cause water shortages. And Dirk mentioned part of this. Of course, you've got China right here. When they start to melt, and if they melt considerably, one, you're going to have flooding down here, and then you're going to have a shortage of water throughout South Asia. No strangers here. You know what happened with Katrina. Certainly, this is Sandy up here. I often talk about not in my backyard attitude that we encounter all the time, that folks really don't care about climate change until it impacts you in the backyard, and then all of a sudden you have a dire concern. And that kind of was the case in New York and New Jersey. Now, Sandy was a Category 1 hurricane. I mean, it wasn't exactly hugely powerful. It wasn't Katrina, that's for sure. But let me give you another poignant example. I took over as commanding general at Parris Island in 1999. Parris Island is 22 feet above mean sea level. And here I am, a bright, young, happy brigadier general, ecstatic that I got the command of my dreams. And my predecessor says, you're going to have one really big problem. And I'm thinking, it's going to be recruiting, it's going to be recruit training, it's going to be drill instructors. And he said, no, it's going to be hurricanes. And I sort of chuckled. He says, but we're prepared. We have an emergency action plan. On deck, we had 8,000 plus recruits and another 2,000 permanent personnel. 60 days later, Hurricane Floyd took dead aim at Parris Island, Category 5. Storm surge estimated to be 30 feet. The storm surge, by the way, from Haiyan, the storm surge was 46 feet, the biggest in history. Needless to say, I was catatonic. And I instigated the emergency action plan, went to the governor at the time, said, you got to declare an emergency so we can evacuate. He was constipated. He just couldn't do anything. And finally, I said, we got to evacuate everybody. So we put roughly about 12,000 people on the road overnight. Worst traffic jam in the Southeast in history. We put them all on the road to Atlanta. We were going to Albany, our supply station for the Marines. And we did it. We took 400 plus buses worth of recruits. Fortunately, Floyd just hit us a glancing blow. It did damage, but nothing severe. Went up to North Carolina, and some may remember, it cut Route 95 in half for 2 weeks. Nobody could go up Route 95 on the East Coast for 2 weeks because of Hurricane Floyd. But just an example, this gives you an illustration of coastal threats. And, you know, here you are down here. Everybody's threatened here. Military bases and stations. This is Homestead Air Force Base after Hurricane Andrew. It gives you an idea of what it can do. Dirk, I hate to say it, to an F-16. And obviously to infrastructure and folks like that. Our military bases and stations, particularly the naval ones, are in dire trouble. Our poster child for that is the naval station in Norfolk, Virginia, which they know big portions of that are going underwater. In fact, the Navy is already underway raising all the pier levels by at least 3 feet because they're not high enough to dock the ships that are coming in. The naval air station there will go underwater. Hampton Roads is a huge problem. And they're clearly familiar with the problem, and they've understand it. They're into the big-time adaptation down in Hampton Roads. But all our coastal stations, Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, has already been flooded severely last year, closed twice because of floods, first time in history. I'm a Marine. The recruit depot in San Diego will probably go underwater. It's all on reclaimed land. I think you get the picture. Well, we got problems in the United States, and you've got problems here, too. And you can just get an example of how things are parched. And we have written a report here about the threat to Louisiana. I have a copy down here on the desk. Please pick it up on the way out. And another one about national security. Katrina, I'm sure, opened your eyes, if it didn't do anything else to everybody down here, the problems of climate change. Now, I often get criticized by saying, well, every hurricane is not the fault of climate change. And that's true. That's weather. And you're going to have huge variances in weather. But what they're showing is they're going to be more extremes. And those extremes are being fed by climate change. And as a consequence, you're going to have storms that are much more intensity in places that you're not used to it. And you're clearly familiar with that down here. Here's a coastal map of Louisiana and wetlands loss. 100 years of land of change for coastal Louisiana. And that right graph, if I remember right, is one of your islands. And that is... Yes, it's Grand Isle. It's exactly what it is. And you can see that it's going underwater. That's your favorite there. Your infrastructure, of course, you all are a coastal community with huge energy infrastructure here between refineries, gas, oil, and energy are all threatened. This is my favorite guy, and I'm not related. I was his executive secretary for a couple of years back in the early 90s, but Dick made the comment about Pakistan. If there was a 1% chance that we know that they were exporting a nuclear weapon to a terrorist, wouldn't we do something? We've got to do something about it. And the same thing applies, frankly, to climate change. Because you get the naysayers, well, if there's a 1% chance that climate change is going to ruin your life, I think you'll start doing something about it. And certainly, that's the case here. We will not, on the military side of the house, every major military command, to include the Pentagon, has what's called the J5 plans. And you get a bunch of eager beaver, usually majors and lieutenant colonels in there looking at every contingency and they're looking at all the contingencies for climate change. So I often get asked, what are we going to do about it? And from my organization's perspective, we are an all-the-above place. We are not ones to say, God bless you, you cannot burn coal anymore, you've got to stop using oil, gas, we've got to stop burning gas. We are not going to wean ourselves off of gas or oil anytime soon. But there are a lot of alternatives out there. Now, coal is a different story. I hear people a lot say clean coal, and I think that's an oxymoron. There is no such thing as clean coal. So we do not like burning of coal. But here's the problem. Now that gasoline is so cheap, we're starting to export coal, and other countries are burning coal at the rapid rate, to include in particular China and somewhat Europe. Now, the government has put restrictions on the export of liquefied natural gas. We've only got a few permits there. We are in favor of exportation of LNG for a variety of reasons, not the least of which it burns about 50% cleaner than oil does. Secondly, you can use that as leverage, of course, with Ukraine. Ukraine is almost totally dependent on Russian natural gas, and Russian has them by the neck. If we could get them off of that and use ours, I think it would be that much better. And a lot of people say, oh, my God, you know, here's a guy who's all for combating climate change saying let's export natural gas, but we actually think there's a benefit to that specifically. Emissions, you know, we've got to do something about the emissions. We worked on it in the CAFE standards that the administration put into effect 2 years ago now. Those can be increased, the efficiency can be increased, we can certainly reduce emissions. And then, you know, you've got to do the adaptation part of it. You know, something's going to come. It's going to be bad. You got to prepare for it and understand what it is. So, I mean, in a nutshell, that's our presentation. And I know it's not exactly uplifting, but my point is that there's a bunch of military folks all over this country, particularly in the Pentagon, and there's a bunch of old farts like us that certainly feel this is a big problem. And I'm not pitching it from the Republican side. I'm not pitching it from the Democratic side. I'm pitching it from the military side that, hey, we're going to spend a lot more money if we don't get our hands around this particular problem, and it's a big problem. So with that, you've been attentive. You've listened to our anecdotes. Let me open it up to a conversation, any questions you might have, and certainly come down and grab the papers. But does anybody have anything you'd like to ask of us? Or have I stunned you into silence? Yes, sir.
This is not... Whereas it is a little bit political, it's not partisan. What do you think, as a retired military, are the chances that another president could come in as commander-in-chief and change the direction that sounds very good to me that the military is taking?
Well, it's hard not to come off partisan on this particular issue, especially when Hagel and Kerry came off our board and one's Secretary of State and the other was Secretary of Defense, because I know precisely where they stood because I've given this brief to both of them. And I think the Obama administration has kind of stepped into this issue fairly well. They've got a plan and they've worked on it and they've done a lot of things that you're not going to see, you wouldn't have seen done with a Republican administration. You know, I think if you just keep pushing the issue and educating, particularly those on the Hill, if you can get a moderate Republican, you get a hard right. Cruz stood up the other day and said he's a huge denier. He doesn't believe in it. It ain't going to happen. So I don't think you'll see much happen if he became president. And I think there's a few others of that ilk who are climate change deniers and wouldn't do anything about it. But hand in glove with the president, you've got to have a Congress that supports, and that's hard. Although they did get a vote back in January that they had an overwhelming majority that said, yes, climate change is happening. And they had about 7 Republicans vote to say, yes, it's man-made. So it was like 53 to 47, something like that. So there's progress, but it's hard.
More specifically, not so good. How much pushback do you think would come from military itself if a new president wanted to turn us in a denier direction?
Well, you know, the military obeys orders and does what it's told. Now they're told to prepare for every contingency.
So they're going to prepare for all the catastrophes that I talked about. But the other side is the vulnerability side of burning fossil fuels and all that business. And I would think you would probably see if an administration said stop doing that, then they'd go back to burning as much fossil fuels as they could. Well, you know, they'd have to for what they're doing. Dirk, would you agree with that?
I think I would say I do believe I agree with that. But turning an aircraft carrier or something of that size is really hard. So I think a lot of people that are working this at all levels in the military are not going to just say, okay, this is no longer important. They may have to find ways to press to make sure that Hampton Roads or Norfolk doesn't go underwater. They may have to argue it a different way, but I really believe that they see the risk and see the necessity. So I believe it would be, I don't know about how hard to push back. I don't think there'd be a coup.
No.
I'm exaggerating, but I think there would be really discussion, hard discussion on it. And I think any new president comes in, takes note of the landscape and begins a dialogue with the Department of Defense, and it's a two-way conversation, unless he says we're going to war, and then they salute and go to war.
I got to offer up two quick examples here. Three, actually. The Army has a big initiative going called zero energy use. In other words, they produce as much energy as they consume, and they're getting real close to that at a number of bases. Dirk just mentioned to me, and I've been there, out to Nellis Air Force Base, which has a huge solar array, and they broke ground on another one this week. They will be totally energy independent when this array gets done. That's pretty cool. I mean, they're working it. Now, my other poignant example is a Marine squad that's sitting on top of a hill in Afghanistan in a combat situation by themselves. And if they can't communicate, if they don't have power, they're almost defenseless. They can't call in airstrikes. They can't call in artillery. They've only got their own small arms. In other words, what they're using for power, or were, was battery operated that had to be replaced, or fuel that was trucked in or dropped in. But now they're using solar arrays to recharge the batteries they got to run all their communications equipment. And the Marine Lance Corporal or Corporals on the deck kind of likes that, because he didn't have to hump the battery in there. He didn't have to protect the fuel line that's coming up. And they just set it up during the day, let it run, store the battery, and use it overnight. So, I mean, that's a real prime example.
I would just comment that a number of us would give similar presentations. We might even know a little bit more scientifically about the topic than you do. But I'd be laughed off the dais by a lot of people because I don't have the kind of credibility that you guys have. And I think that is powerful stuff, the fact that the military is willing to take up this topic. The military is not known for being screaming left-wing fanatics. And I would say any president who takes office is going to learn really soon that you have to rely on your military, because there's going to be an occasion that's going to require it.
Sure.
And I believe that it'll be unlikely that if the military takes a strong position on this issue, any president, regardless of ideology, is going to buck it.
Well, I defer to your expertise. I appreciate
but
that.
But I'm just telling you, I'm used to experiencing is I'm hardly a left-wing fanatic myself, but I have very little credibility when I take this to certain parts of the public.
Well, thank you for the compliment here. Yes, ma'am.
Have you guys considered a coalition with insurance risk underwriters? Because when you're talking about American security, you're talking about risk management.
Yeah, absolutely.
So having the advocacy that contingency stakeholder reports are planned for smart growth, then you don't see the experience of these huge payouts like we did with BP or Katrina and volatility risk, like the financial side of that, that topples, you know, the markets, that as much as people would want to say that the mortgage collapse stands on its own, I'm going to always believe that part of the reason why the mortgage collapse happened at the moment it happened was the payout to make that call for meeting that gap.
Sure.
That really brought that collapse at that moment, as opposed to maybe 5 years later or at some other point. And so talking about the cash flow and the currency volatility, protecting that is a stable group.
No, you're spot on. We have dealt with a number of insurance companies, and I think perhaps the biggest one who's gotten most involved is Zurich Re.
Right.
And if you're familiar, they do a big climate week in New York in conjunction with the UN General Assembly, and John Kerry came and keynoted it, and I played a big part. It was mostly that particular part was sponsored by Zurich Re. But the interesting part about this is, of course, all companies are in a business,
right,
and they're out, you know, they're not going to insure you at a loss.
Right.
So the prediction, the actuarial side of the house is, you know, I've given you gloom and doom here. So they're thinking, when is that going to happen, and how much am I going to charge you to insure your house? Because I know when the next hurricane's coming. Oh, by the way, it's going to be 185 miles an hour. You get my drift on this.
Right. And except by changing the standards of the underwriting policy criteria. By having a stakeholders report, almost like an environmental site assessment,
yes,
added in that, would force each of the business incrementally to handle their own risk every year in their renewal process.
Yeah, we,
which would then be your status report that you pull out in a crisis, so that you're mitigating the risk across the economy.
You have a great point. I wouldn't argue a single part of that.
Yeah.
One of the guys on my board is an actuarial, a very prominent one, who's taught this specific issue a number of times, and your solution is a good one. The problem is,
we're actually trying to stow that.
Yeah, that's exactly right, but that is a great point.
Voluntarily getting businesses,
yes,
you know, because they've been through emergency response,
yeah,
crises here, that if they lead the way by saying, we're going to take care of ourselves and show insurance companies that we're being prudent,
right,
and transparent, and that we're prepared, would that start to create a market expectation?
Right.
Great comment.
Yes, sir.
Could you talk some about what is happening in the Arctic? And
oh, yes.
Maine?
Yeah. Sherry's the expert on this now, right?
We had a big show.
Yeah. First, let me preface this with this statement. There's a lot of alarmism being raised about it. And I'll get into that here in a minute. But first off, the Arctic's a pretty well-regulated area. We've got the Arctic Council. You've got the Law of the Sea Convention, which the United States refuses to ratify, but 134 other countries have. And there are statutes there, and if you want to go to a specific place, it's regulated. As Admiral Path will tell you, who will head the Arctic Council here next month, I believe, U.S. takes over chairmanship of it. It's actually one of the few places where there's been a great deal of cooperation. That's number one. Probably not what you want to hear. Number two is it's melting fast and at an unprecedented rate. And it's going to become a major transit route between Asia and Europe. And then the corollary to that is who's patrolling that, who controls it, and then who ultimately owns part of it, and are there going to be charges, or are they going to drill there? I mean, there's all kinds of questions. The Russians, if I remember right, have 17 icebreakers. We have one. And when you talk to the Commandant of Coast Guard, he sits there and goes, what would you like me to do in the Arctic with my one icebreaker? Which, oh, by the way, has got duties in other places as well. Horribly underfunded as far as the Coast Guard goes. The United States Navy says, well, we don't have a base there. You know, we've got a significant coast with Alaska. You want us to put a base up there? Okay, who's funding that? And by the way, they're cutting their shipbuilding budget. So how are they going to get the ships up there? I think you see all this. There is cause for alarm with the Russians in particular and what they're doing. They have a huge military exercise going this week, as a matter of fact, that has drawn the attention of a lot of people in the Pentagon that's going in their part of the Arctic. And you got to wonder, why? Don't they have other problems, maybe like down towards Ukraine. I don't know, but does that answer your question on the Arctic?
Yes.
Do you have you anything to add on that? You're pretty close to it.
Well, I mean, it's changing fast, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
And people are aware of that. Just a comment on the Russians. The thing that brought the Russians down and ended the Cold War was their economic situation. And I really don't think Putin can sustain much of a military presence based on what their economy is doing right now and the soft oil prices.
You mean military presence nationwide or
the
in the Arctic?
Kind of multi-force, multi-jurisdictional or multi-location kind of. You can't fight a two-front war. It's hard for us now to worry about that sort of thing. But if the Ukraine is a real problem for him, he's going to have a hard time policing the Arctic as well. Given his disastrous it's a mess.
I wouldn't argue that point either. Of course, what he's put a lot of attention on his military in the last 2 years. As you may recall, I mean, their readiness and their whole state of morale and everything went through the toilet, and it was terrible. And he's brought them up, and he's upped their defense budget dramatically. And how he's paying for that.
Well, that's the point. He's got to pay for it eventually.
Yeah, how he's paying for it, who knows. And more into Dirk's line, he's now starting to talk about tactical nuclear weapons.
That's scary.
He said, well, if I can't do it with conventional forces, I'll just have a tactical nuke that, you know, I'll use. And that's got everybody.
Along those lines, I was at a conference 2 weeks ago, and there were a lot of Russians there who were from the period when we were really having quite a good dialogue. This was after the Cold War was over, and we were actually under Nunn Lugar spending a lot of money to control and to secure fissile material and all of that. But there was also representation, retired two-star level in the Russian Department of Defense, that's Defense Minister. And he was going through the litany of what they're spending money on. Of course, I'm trying to keep an awareness of that because they are modernizing their nuclear forces quite aggressively. Articles this week on reestablishing the Russian Pacific Fleet, which went under after the Cold War. Now, you're exactly right about how much he's bitten off of. They've got terrible infrastructure all through the Crimea, and they're supporting that war. They've got real big problems, but they're flying those bear bombers through the English Channel now, and they're flying them to Vietnam and using our base that we built there. And so there's one side that says the Russian people are cheering him on because they don't like the way we've rubbed their noses in their circumstances and that they will bear any sacrifice. So I think the real answer, nobody really knows, but he's bitten off a lot that he's got to pay for.
Well, he can certainly do a lot of damage and create a lot of trouble, but whether he can sustain a long-term effort is really the issue.
Yeah.
Talking about tactical nuclear weapons is totally irresponsible and just crazy. But it's not far from being revisiting the Cold War. I mean, it's really not that far.
I don't think the Americans have appreciated the Crimean situation the way the Russians think about it. The Battle of the Light Brigade, all that sort of stuff. They don't realize that it really is something important in the hearts of
it is.
This Russian two-star went on and on about A, B, C, D. This is the way you have embarrassed us, rubbed our noses in it, made us feel like we were this. Now, I don't think that's so smart that we have done it. Or at least they believe we've done it.
Perception.
Yep.
It's a very volatile and difficult situation. Yes, sir.
Another area that I think would really do us a lot of good, and I'm not paying any attention to it. Maybe you can address any efforts within DARPA programs towards sustainable energy technology? Has there been a major push?
I think those in DOD would say DARPA is horribly underfunded, as I think all research and development in the country is underfunded.
6.1 and 6.2 don't exist anymore, right?
DARPA is working on projects. I don't know specifically what they are, but I know they are. All kinds of stuff, but not to the level it should be. And I think a lot of this on the energy side in particular should be in the commercial and academic sector. I mean, shouldn't be a DOD research project. It should be DOE research project, meaning Department of Energy, and from that side.
Let me shift gears a little bit. How much effort or resources are being devoted towards a monitoring of conditions, real-time monitoring of conditions in some of these hotspot areas?
Oh, big time. You're probably familiar, I could go into it, but there are 10 combatant commanders, 7 geographic commands. Each one's responsible for a portion of the world. Pacific Command, I mentioned to you, he's the biggest one, but UCOM, Central Command, SOUTHCOM, NORTHCOM, they have their finger on that pulse. AFRICOM, big time, and that's their job. I mean, they're there to monitor the situations in all the countries that are underneath their area of responsibility. And they are very conversant in watching what's happening and how much climate's contributing.
Yeah, well, I meant was, what are y'all doing for monitoring of ocean conditions or meteorological information in areas that are very sparse? I mean, what is going in? How are y'all getting that putting out stations in these areas?
You mean y'all, meaning the Department of Defense?
Yeah, exactly. The military has to have in these hotspot areas, they're almost black holes in terms of meteorological information. They're black holes in terms of being able to understand what the local conditions are, especially when you're looking at focusing, having to put resources, you have to make maybe an amphibious landing on. Plan for these things, you know. How are y'all planning stuff like that?
Well, I know from the Marine perspective, we watch all of those areas. Now, you can't map out or you can't study everything. You kind of look at the hot spots and think, what's the potential of us going there? If there is, do we have a war plan for it? If we have a war plan for it, what are we coming over the beach, which these days is kind of rare? How can we position our ships? I know that we work obviously work in conjunction with the Navy big time. Do you have anything to add from the ocean side?
I would say if you would go up to Erdig, up to Vicksburg, like Vicksburg, where the Army Corps has their research group, you know, there are people there working on hydrologic modeling all over the world, and yeah. It's trying to do very rapid simulations for based upon a hotspot or some digital elevation map they get. They put it in there and they're running those things. The Navy does a lot of sensing, let's say, of coastal regions, right? And if you kind of follow some of the funding I think ONR has put out recently,
yeah.
It's gone from, kind of mine detection based on certain unfortunate incidents, right, to now looking more at deltaic systems, because they're looking at areas that could potentially be hotspots and better understanding how they can, it's not studying it for the research, it's not studying it for the basic science as much as it's studying it so that they can use the tools they have.
Right.
To then see what changes are happening or what the conditions are.
Sure.
So can you put an amphibious vehicle on that beach, low tide, high tide, whatever it is, right?
Right.
Depending on
the conditions. So. Yeah, and of course you're probably all familiar. The Navy we're moving away from the coast, becoming over the horizon type organization, especially with V-22 and all our ways of movement are long standing. Of course, the Marines' primary thing is. It's called a P-7 amphibious vehicle, which is only about 35 years old. They're trying to get a new one now for years, and their problem is R&D, and it's gone way off budget. And the current new commandant took over last fall has put this as his number one budget priority, is a vehicle that can travel 35 or 40 knots and go across the beach. But we're a ways away from doing that. And I think the days of marine amphibious landings are few and far between.
Steve, let me just add from a little different perspective. NASA and NOAA are, of course, probably constrained budget-wise as well, but I'm pretty familiar with the their satellite effort. Yep. And that combined with, so I would say from space, I think we're getting a pretty hard look at how the oceans and how the various hotspots are looking in terms of
What I use is a pretty big disappointment in terms of its coverage. That's the Ocean Observing System. And Bill will talk a lot about this because he tries to deal with them all the time. NOAA's budget is sorely constrained.
Right, I agree.
And then, you know, the Navy can do things like send up P3s and send out an SBT or something like that if they've got an acute problem. But in terms of having sufficient number of XDAM monitoring stations, no, it's not going on. I mean, we're struggling just to keep, what, five stations?
Three.
We're down to three now?
Okay. But how much of this can you do with the polar orbiting every 90 minutes coverage that you can get from the various...
You can do some, but you can't do acoustic Doppler profiling and stuff that you may want to do.
Well, I think that's good to know. I think that's the sort of information that would be useful as we talk to the Hill.
One of the biggest problems, I got to go back to the DP oil spill, is nobody could truly understand why oil was washing up here and why it was over here and not here and here. And when I say here and here, I'm talking initially, everybody said it was going to hit Grand Isle and wash up there first. Well, it never showed up there. It showed up in Terrebonne Bay first.
Yeah.
And people were mystified about that. What they didn't understand was the ocean, the little fine scale circulatory patterns that typically occur during that time of the year.
And we didn't have HF radar. That's another ridiculous thing. Of all places in the country, the Gulf needs high frequency radar.
Yeah.
If you're going to look at the surface East Bay, that's what you need.
I had a proposal put in to look at a couple of Vera stations and these are HF systems, but one of the things they wanted me to do was to be able to go out and get those systems and bring them in during the hurricanes. And I said, well, where you want me to put them is extremely hard to get to, for starters, number one. And I said, why don't I just really harden them for a hurricane? And actually build a raised, elevated structure that would survive a hurricane, and the storm surge that goes with it. And they bought the price of it.
Yeah, we operate with now three stations on oil platforms.
I was just going to say, they've got a lot of platforms out there.
Well,
I figured out how to do it. It just seems like...
But the problem is, I mean, we're not even solid-state technology because we can't afford it. So when a hurricane comes along, we get knocked out. The most interesting and important time, we're not able to provide any information.
That's right. Now, I have a tie-in with NASA in terms of the AeroNet. I'm sure you've heard of the AeroNet robotic system. We've got sea prisms sun photometers that look at and get you aerosol content. Now, the aerosol content is extremely important in being able to derive a lot of your satellite imagery products, and knowing the what your aerosol content is, and knowing what your color of the oceans are, plays a very important role in terms of being able to accurately develop and calibrate your satellite imagery for picking up, say, like surface temperatures, salinities, chlorophyll. These are byproducts, but the more important ones is surface temperature and sea level to some degree. But, you know, it's just amazing to me that they're struggling. They're having trouble funding. I'm trying to keep the one sea prism we have operating in the Gulf of Mexico going.
Wow. Yes, ma'am.
We were talking about, again, campaigning to change that culture of thinking of that as an expenditure for the 1%, but extent to go to the extra risk manager level, again, I would like to campaign and say, could we, if people chose to do that, is there a way to offset with insurance risk underwriting, say, we've gone the extra mile, can we get a premium break that swaps the costs? More so than, and try to create that culture of energy in the private sector between the companies that are bearing the risk, as opposed to thinking of it as a tax, somehow or the other, a business incentive to be better risk managers.
Yeah.
As opposed to just profit.
Nope, gotcha.
Maximize.
One more. Anybody else? Well, thank you very much. I mean, this has just been a pleasure. LSU, what a great campus. And I'm impressed by your facility, and I'm impressed by your interest in sticking through this whole thing. So we've got our website, americansecurityproject.org, pretty simple. Has all this stuff on the website. You just hit the climate icon on there, and you pull that up. Please come down and take our reports and interested in feedback, too. So thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.